Do you ever wonder how government in Cincinnati operates? Like, really operates? Sign up for WVXU's City Government 101 newsletter. You'll learn all the basics and more in a weekly email, giving you the tools you need to stay informed and get involved. Sign up at WVXU.org.
Mr. Hill here, but you can call me Dave. Dave from before, Dave Hill from Show Business. Actually, the more I think about it, go back to Mr. Hill. I do kind of like that. And today, I'm joined by comedian and author Lane Moore from the new Scrubs, Ava Bunn, plus Emmy-winning writer Allison Zeitman. It's the novelizers. I don't know, we could put some effect on that, I guess.
One day we will.
Welcome to the Novelizers. I'm Dave Hill, mentioned earlier, and if I were to accurately describe how good this week's show is, I'd be forced to slap an X rating on this podcast.
Hey, Dave.
Oh, hey, Steven.
I'm here, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I didn't forget you so much as choose not to address you.
Oh, sorry. I'll go back into my hole here.
No, you're out. Just keep talking when you feel necessary.
Hey, we were at the same concert in New York the other day, I heard.
We were?
Yeah, Instagram told me.
At Bell and Sebastian?
That's correct.
You were at that concert on Friday?
Yeah, I was.
How do we not see each other? Was it the thousands of people?
I think it must have been.
To be fair, I was also a bit drunk.
Oh, yeah. Not me. I was stone cold sober.
So you didn't see the meet and greet that I had set up?
I somehow wasn't invited to that. Yeah.
They were great. I'm a big novelizers fan. Let's just get that out of the way. But I'm a big Bell and Sebastian fan, and my friends that I'm also a big fan of, the Ladybug Transistor, they were opening.
They were fantastic too.
Yeah, I was hanging with the band, whatever.
Oh, I should have let you know I was in town. You could have introduced me to Stuart Murdoch. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people were saying like, "Hey, I was at that show." I did see a fair amount of people running into people. I had a nice time.
It was a great show.
Yeah, I really like them a lot. They're great at music.
They are good at music.
I said great.
Oh, they are great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you dance? Do you dance at a show? What's Dave Hill like at a show when you're in the audience? Were you backstage
hanging, backstage.
Too cool to dance. Yeah.
No, I was at this side of the stage briefly, but I don't really enjoy that. I like to be in the audience. So just to be clear, I was at the side of the stage. Just let everyone know that.
Yeah.
But just briefly. And then I was like, come on, let's get back out there and rock out.
I was bopping around. And then I was back the next night and it was pouring.
I wish I had gone the next night. I couldn't, but I would have liked to.
Yeah, it was a fun show the next night.
Yeah, they should play every weekend in New York.
Then I would have to move back to New York.
I would love it. They're one of my favorite bands, probably.
Really? That, I don't know. I just added a new puzzle piece to the complexity that is Dave Hill.
Well, yeah, I think people wrongfully, yet understandably, think that I'm just always hard rocking out at the very lightest.
But yeah.
The fact is, I'm a complex person.
I guess so.
With many musical interests.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah.
Bell and Sebastian.
Ground floor fan.
Wow, really?
That's not entirely true. I actually didn't hear them until If You're Feeling Sinister came out, which was...
That's pretty ground floor.
It's pretty early, like first, yeah. Whatever, second row, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, right. I don't know if too many Americans knew them before that.
Yeah, that was my introduction to them. And a surprising thing, it's not my favorite record by them.
Oh, yeah?
I know a lot of people love that record the most, but not me.
If you want to find out what Dave Hill's favorite Bell and Sebastian is, just write in to thenovelizers@gmail.com and ask him, and maybe he'll tell us.
I'll tell you.
And this also isn't the Bell and Sebastian fan podcast.
But Well, yeah, I anticipate you'll probably get a lot of listener mail saying, gosh, when you guys went off on that Belle and Sebastian tear, more of that, please.
Yeah. And there is more. We'll deliver. But you have to write.
Yeah, I could honestly see talking about Teenage Fan Club for just as long, if not longer.
Let's do it right now.
I've seen Teenage Fan Club many times, but I've only seen Belle and Sebastian that one time, Friday.
Oh, that was your first time.
Yeah, I don't know how. It's just the way life has worked out. I've never seen him. It wasn't I was resisting it. I just somehow never did. But I've seen Teenage Fan Club many times.
Nice.
Just to name another Glasgow band.
Yeah, yeah. Glasgow, like Dayton, punches above its weight in terms of musical.
It does. What do you got? Mogwai is from there?
Yeah, we have to get my wife on the mic. She knows every Glasgow. That's her thing.
I'm pretty well versed in Glasgow. I've been there many times. Big fan.
It's a great
one of my favorite cities, actually, in the world.
You know what? I'm going to say me too.
I would absolutely live there and be delighted.
The weather in the winter is a little depressing.
Well, being from Cleveland, I'm well prepared for it.
Oh, yeah.
I know the despair of endless gray skies.
It is also, you've never enjoyed whiskey unless you've enjoyed it in like this fucking cold, rainy Glasgow bar.
Oh, completely.
That's the way it's meant to be consumed.
Yes. I feel like I wanted to start raining so I can drink whiskey now, but I shan't because we have an episode.
Let's do it.
We can't be giving away all this bonus content we've got. We've got an episode.
Yeah, yeah.
To discuss. This, of course, is The Novelizers, the only show in the podcast-iverse where classic films are turned into hilarious audiobooks narrated by your favorite people. People like, I don't know, Lane Moore, an award-winning writer, actor, comedian, and musician. She's been hailed by the New York Times as ingenious. She's also the creator of Tinder Live and the author of books like You Will Find Your People. We've also got Alison Zeidman, an Emmy-nominated writer and comedian who's worked on shows including Archer, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and Adam Ruins Everything.
Two solid shows. Three solid shows. Sorry.
Well, that could be taken many ways. I've worked on Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, which is an excellent program that should still be on, in my medical opinion.
I agree.
We've also got Ava Bunn. She's in the cast of Scrubs reboot for ABC and appears on Netflix's series A Man on the Inside, starring Ted Danson. Oh, great to hear they gave Ted Danson another show. He's not in enough shows. You know, I'm not... Well, okay, let's just come back to this. She's also in Five Star Weekend for Peacock with Jennifer Garner and Chloe Sevigny, but Jesus, could you just sit out a season, Ted Danson?
He's back with a vengeance. Everything.
I have nothing against him, though clearly I do, but like, I'm kind of good. I don't need to see him in any more shows. He's been in shows nonstop for 40-some years.
Look, the kids today, they're demanding more Danson.
Good
more Danson.
God.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, here's another show. What if we have Ted Danson star in it? Yeah, you're great, Ted. I get it. Enough. I've had it. Same for you, Paul Rudd, if you're listening. Same for you, John Hamm. They're all great. Oh, and dear friends, let's be clear.
And John Hamm, apparently about to do this show.
I think I'm told he lives right down the street from me, but I've never seen him around.
He looks like any other guy. Easy to miss.
Yeah, whereas I, on the other hand, stop in your tracks. Here he comes, DH. Anyway, this season we're novelizing The Dark Knight, a Chris Nolan film so dark and brooding it decimated Gotham City's once thriving tourism industry. And here's where we are in the film. Do you want to take this one, Stephen?
I would love to, Dave. After threatening Maroni, Harvey finds out Ramirez is the other police mole. The Joker gives two boats the detonator to the bomb on the other. Wait, what? I didn't write this, by the way.
I knew you were doing this summary, but then I had to get in there to understand it myself. It sounds like each boat has a detonator that could blow up the other, maybe. Anyway, you know what my point is? Lane Moore, novelize me, and also Steven to a lesser extent.
The Dark Knight, Chapter 21. I No Longer Believe in Harvey Dent. Novelized by Alison Zeidman, narrated by Lane Moore. Maroni gets into his car. If you forgot who Maroni is, here's a refresher. He's one of the mafia bosses working with the Joker, which means he's a badass bad guy who doesn't care about the rules. You can also tell he's a bad guy because he's Eric Roberts, and post-9/11 Eric Roberts pretty much always plays bad guys. Also, he tells his driver not to stop for cops or red lights or nothing. This guy doesn't give one solitary fudge. And maybe it's because Maroni has such complete disregard for the law that it takes him a full 3 seconds to regard that Harvey Dent, Gotham's most famous and accomplished lawyer, has been sitting back there the whole time just casually holding a gun. When Maroni finally does notice Harvey, he looks like he just saw a goat. Yes, you heard that right. A goat, not a ghost. Maroni doesn't believe in ghosts, so his reaction is more like, wait, where'd this goat come from? But then there's also this glimmer of fear in his eyes that says, wait, Harvey Dent's supposed to be dead, but I can see him right now. So do I believe in ghosts? Or, even worse, do I believe in Harvey Dent? Am I going to have to get one of those stupid campaign buttons? We all get a lot of that subtext in just that split second because Eric Roberts is just that good. But Harvey's all cool, calm, and collected. He asks Maroni if he's on his way to meet his wife. Maroni doesn't answer because he's not. At best, he's probably on his way to meet his mistress. Then Harvey asks if he loves his wife, and Maroni says, yes. Period. Full stop. That's it. No elaboration. He might as well have said, sure, why not? And maybe Maroni really does love his wife. Or maybe he doesn't. That's not the point. His dispassionate response is strategic. He's hoping to distract Harvey by forcing him to wonder what's really going on in that marriage. But it doesn't work. Harvey Dent isn't a marriage counselor, and his superpower is that he's immune to juicy hot goss. He just wants Maroni to think about how it would feel to listen to his wife die like he had to do with Rachel. Seems like a lot of trouble to go to just by trying to get Maroni to empathize, but whatever. Maroni tells Dent to take it up with the Joker. He's like, look, man, I was just following orders. And before you try to call me out on that by saying something like, you know who else said that? The Nazis. You should know I'm a big fan of the Nazis, so that line won't work on me. But it turns out that Harvey doesn't give two shits about the Joker. Sure, he's Gotham's hard prosecuting district attorney who's dedicated his life to eradicating Gotham's criminals. But this one criminal, arguably the biggest, evilest, and most unpredictable criminal the city has ever seen, he gets a pass because, look, Harvey's reasoning doesn't have to follow any kind of discernible logic anymore. He's a villain now. Are you really expecting him to have the clear, kind of justifiable in an evil way ideology of, say, a Thanos or Killmonger? Let it go. So anyway, Harvey's like, the Joker? Big fat whatever. Who's your other man in Gordon's unit who kidnapped Rachel? And Maroni's like, well, first of all, why do you automatically assume it was a man? Lady cops can be corrupted too, you sexist. And second of all, if I tell you, do you promise you'll let me go? And Harvey's just like, shrug, maybe. But apparently that's good enough for Maroni because he gives up Ramirez just like that. And Harvey's like, cool, thanks, meet my gun now. And Maroni's like, hey, no fair, you promised. And Harvey's like, that's not actually what happened. We're going to let this coin decide. This is the moment where the audience remembers, oh, right, Harvey Dent never developed the emotional maturity to face difficult decisions head on and take responsibility for his choices. And he turned that into what he thinks is this charming little coin flip thing. So Dent flips his little coin, and when it lands on no killsies, he tells Maroni he's a very lucky boy. But he's not. And Maroni's like, who? And Harvey's all, your driver, bitch. And then he shoots the driver in the back of the head, which is honestly a pretty badass line. And as the car careens out of control and crashes and flips in the air, we don't actually hear him say it. Maroni's like, damn, that was a pretty badass line. I gotta give you that. Meanwhile, a huge crowd has formed at the ferry docks trying to evacuate the city. And they're pissed because the National Guard is giving priority on one of the two ferries to prisoners. But it turns out you're lucky if you're a law-abiding citizen who got left behind, because suddenly the power goes out on both ferries and everyone's like, whoa. The crews on each boat investigate and discover explosives rigged to blow the engine rooms, along with packages containing the detonators. The Joker wrapped them. What a thoughtful touch. He's like the Martha Stewart of criminal psychopaths. The Joker hijacks the ship's intercoms and tells everyone they're going to be a part of a little social experiment, because the Joker just finished taking Sociology 101 at Gotham City College, and now he's one of those bros who thinks he's so smart, can get away with doing fucked up shit just by calling it a social experiment. And the Joker's conducting the worst social experiment since Improv Everywhere. Each fairy is in possession of the detonator for the other boat, and unless one blows up the other by midnight, the Joker is gonna blow up everyone. Fox is catching all this on the Bat sonar, cell phone, tracker thing that Batman rigged to tap every phone in Gotham, which Fox still isn't comfortable with, but Batman just keeps shouting, "Patriot Act!" anytime Fox tries to say anything about it. Fox tells Batman what he's hearing and where it's coming from, and then Batman tells Gordon and says he has Joker's location. And Fox is listening and thinking, wait, what? Like, he figured it out all by himself? And so Fox has to wonder if Batman isn't giving him any of the credit to protect his secret identity, or if he's just kind of a dick. Fox has always suspected that if Bruce Wayne were Batman, he'd be the worst middle management supervisor in all of Wayne Enterprises. Meanwhile, back on the ferries, everyone's like, holy shit, holy shit. But the ferry captains aren't doing anything just yet. Prisoners all just panic at once, which sounds like the boat of civilians is quieter, and people speak one at a time without talking over each other, which sounds like, wah, my life, wah, until one of them says, they should put this to a vote. Meanwhile, the prisoners are still rumbling, and their inability to take turns speaking is so frustrating to one guard, he fires his rifle at the ceiling. Even more meanwhile, Ramirez calls Barbara, Gordon's wife, and tells her to pack it up and get the kids in the car, because the cops outside protecting them are actually bad guys. And for a second, Barbara is like, wait, what? Why isn't Jim the one telling me this? Like, seriously? He's too busy to make his own phone call to tell his family they're in imminent mortal danger? So she does what Ramirez tells her, and she also makes a mental note to add this to a list of things to bring up in couples counseling next week. After Ramirez hangs up, we see Harvey Dent is holding a gun to her head, and he forced her to make the call. He's dragged the totally innocent Gordon family into this just to make a point that they trusted Ramirez, just like Rachel did. Okay. And he also ultimately blames Gordon for Rachel's death because, whatever, he's insane and on a rampage. That's all the justification that you need. As for Ramirez's fate, he flips his little coin, and again, it lands on no kill Z's, so he tells her she gets to live. But before he leaves, he slaps her hard across the face because he's not going to miss a perfectly good opportunity to live out one of his top Real Housewives of New Jersey fantasies. He's such a Teresa. Gordon has no idea any of this is happening. Snipers are preparing to take out the Joker's clown henchmen, ready to go. But just as Gordon is about to give the order, behind them, Batman is like, no, don't. And it's like, Jesus, dude, what if one of the snipers startled easily and just started shooting? Why can't you just enter the room like a normal person? Is it, like, a Batman thing? Or is Bruce Wayne also at home, sneaking up behind Alfred every 5 minutes, like, hey, what you doing? Giving him a heart attack? Gordon is like, what the fuck, Batman? We don't have time for this. Batman said he just needs 5 minutes with the Joker, and Gordon's like, I said no, but... But he doesn't even get the chance to finish saying bitch, because Batman's already jumped off the roof and gliding over there, which really seems like more of a flying squirrel thing than a Batman thing, but fine. At the same time, Fox has a clear, almost X-ray-like view of everything in the building because of the eavesdropping sonar thing, which is or isn't realistic depending on how much you know about science stuff, and he's giving Batman intel and directions. Gordon has stepped away for a sec to take a call from his wife, and he's like, God damn it, woman, stop being so hysterical. But then Harvey Dent is on his phone, and he's like, oh shit, that's why she's so hysterical. It's not just her silly woman uterus making her act silly. Back on Batman, the SWAT team is about to storm the building when suddenly the eyes of Batman's mask light up, which counterintuitively signal that he's hearing something, and what his lit-up eyes hearing is the sound of hostages trying to yell through gags from under the clown masks. Batman tells Fox, oh shit, the clowns are hostages. But Fox can't do anything about it,
So he should really be calling Gordon, but it's already been established that he's a direct line to Gordon. So it's like, why is he doing that? But we have to remember that Batman is human, and even he can get frazzled sometimes, and he doesn't think very clearly. Batman saves the hostages by using his grappling hook thing to tie up the SWAT team instead of his words, and sending those guys over on the side of the building even though they did nothing wrong. And then he goes back to beat up the doctors, who are the real henchmen, and who are also carrying guns, but just aren't willing to shoot them for some reason. I guess those henchmen were under the impression that this was going to be a non-violent, diabolical plan, and oh boy, are they in over their heads now. Batman's all like, kick, punch, punch again. Then Batman beats up more of the SWAT guys that get in the way. Kick, punch, punch again. But he's actually saving everyone, sort of. So it's like, it's okay, he's beating the shit out of them, maybe? Batman's personal code of ethics is a little murky. Hopefully, Bruce Wayne will at least cover these guys' hospital bills later, though, because seriously, like, what the hell? Back on the ferries, the so-called civilians have reached a majority vote in favor of blowing up their fellow human beings. Look, if those prisoners don't want to get blown up, maybe they should have thought of that before they went to prison. Sure, some of them might just be in there for, like, weed possession. This movie takes place before Gotham legalized weed, but too bad. Don't do the crime if you can't do the possibility that you might get senselessly mass murdered. The civilian ferry captain is having second thoughts, though. He's always felt a sense of shame being the captain of the ferry boat as opposed to, like, a 150-foot catamaran. But a ferry boat is still a boat, damn it. And that means he is still an officer of the seas. And an officer of the seas must hold themselves and their passengers to a higher standard of... No. Just kidding. This guy's a scared little bitch. Back to the tower with the hostages. Oh, god damn it. More SWAT team snipers? All right, then. I guess kick, punch, punch again? Maybe this is Batman trying to make a larger statement against over-policing and the increased militarization of policing in America? I mean, good point, for sure. But it seems like not the time. And also just a little bit hypocritical coming from a guy who's all, eat my bat rocket launcher, people I decide deserve it. But one can only kick, punch, and punch again so much, and eventually Batman's surrounded by SWAT guys, and the snipers have them in their sights. Once again, Batman's roped them all up around the ankles with his grappling hook thingy, like a badass bat cowboy who knows how to do cool lasso tricks. So he just kicks one guy over the side, and all the rest fall after him. And the rest of the SWAT team just lets Batman get away, which would be a huge fuck up. Except that finally someone realizes what's going on and is like, oh, whoops. Be advised, y'all. The doctors are actually the hostages. Our bad.
Thank you, Lane Moore. We'll be right back with so much more novelizers right after this.
Do you ever wonder how government in Cincinnati operates? Like, really operates? Sign up for WVXU's City Government 101 newsletter. You'll learn all the basics and more in a weekly email, giving you the tools you need to stay informed and get involved. Sign up at WVXU.org.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
And we're back. Each week on the show, we talk to someone who actually worked on the film The Dark Knight. Let's hear that interview, shall we?
Welcome back to the interview portion of the Novelizers. I'm Christine, and I am so excited to be joined today by our guest. She was the intimacy coordinator on the film The Dark Knight, and her name is Regina Butts. Is it Butts, correct?
Yes, Regina Butts. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Regina. Tell me, what was your involvement on the film, and how was it for you?
It was a joy. I mean, intimacy coordinating is the light of my life. I had a wonderful time. I was studying at Columbia Chicago Gender Studies, and I was looking for an internship position, and I found an opening and I decided to pave my way. So,
wow. Okay. So you were technically an intern working on the film.
Yes. For credit.
For credit. Oh, for college credit. Wow. So first of all, for anyone who's not familiar with the industry, can you just briefly describe what an intimacy coordinator does on the set of a film?
An intimacy coordinator basically choreographs sexual scenes or kissing scenes or anytime another actor is really touching another actor. And I make sure that both parties are very comfortable.
So how does this work? You go on set, you pull the actors who are going to be involved in some sort of intimate scene together, and you choreograph. Is that right?
Yes. I can also deal with personal relations if people have special requests, like, you know, Christian Bale wanted more touching. He said he had been deprived of touch for years. So I negotiated with Maggie Gyllenhaal at the time, and I said, hey, he's going to need a little more touch. Let's bring it on.
So I have to say, that does feel like a little wrong in a way, that like the lead actor could say, like, I want to have more sexual contact with my, you know, my scene partner, and that you would facilitate that. Because isn't the whole point that like only what is necessary would be choreographed?
Yes, but something you have to remember is it was 2008. So we did prioritize the needs of the actor. You know, what Bruce Wayne wants, Bruce Wayne gets.
I would love to know, like, walk me through what this conversation is. So you pull Christian Bale and Maggie Gyllenhaal together, and how do you conduct it? Like, what? How does it start?
So basically, I explain to them what a no-no square is. Are you familiar with the no-no square?
No.
That's your range of where we're going to say no, right? And for me, my no-no square is just this neck mole right here. It's very hot, and I don't want, so touch my titties all you want, not the neck mole.
Okay. So just for clarification, your no-no square, does that apply like in your life as just like a person having sex with people?
Yes. I like to apply it to my life because I do think that we should all be the own intimacy coordinator of our lives. Before I sleep with anybody, I tell them that. And I let them know that I will be coordinating my own intimacy. And by that, you won't be touching that circle right there.
So couldn't you just like put a Band-Aid on that mole?
So I don't know why I'd want to cover up my imperfections.
I like that. Okay, but you definitely don't want anyone to touch it. And what happens if it gets touched in sex?
The first time it happened, it was in college. And we were just simply playing a game of 7 minutes in heaven. And I got locked in a room with this guy, Sam Guillemette. And I just said, hey, look, we don't have to do this if you don't want to. And then he said, so true. Then he begins to put his hand just anywhere to sort of find the light switch. He's looking for the light switch with two fingers, and he hits that spot. I started screaming at the top of my lungs, to which then we both started kind of running back and forth. I knocked my head on the rack of clothes, concussed. I wake up, I'm naked and wet on the floor.
Oh, I don't know how you got naked that quickly or unconscious. That's a really bad sign.
It's really bad.
So do you have discomfort as an intimacy coordinator, or is it hard for you to do this job?
So that's actually kind of a part of my big journey, was being liberated. And that liberation almost came from my wake up, naked on the floor, wet. I felt like I was in the womb again. And I think we should all try to return to that state when we can.
So you get into intimacy coordinating and you're working on the set of The Dark Knight, but you're an intern at this point. So you're young and you're probably just learning this for the first time on set, like how to do this.
The reason why they actually brought me in is because I was protesting outside of their set. We were protesting for women.
Just in general?
Yeah, just general women's stuff. And they said, we need someone like you on set because, you know that scene in the hospital with the Joker?
There are a couple, but I think I know which one you're referencing.
The big, you know, the one. So he actually said that he wanted to wear his nurse's outfit like a kilt and just go nothing under. And that was a request from the actor, and you have to respect that. And the other people on set kind of felt a little bit uncomfortable with that. And then they looked at me, the face of comfort, and said, let's have her meld these worlds.
That's a huge responsibility for an intern.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
I spent a lot of nights crying. You know, I have people spit in my face, scream at me, yell at me, tell me I'm worthless.
What's the reason for that? Why are you getting so much heat?
I always think it's a reflection of them because I'm just here doing my job. I come up, I whisper my hot breath into their ear, and I give them their instructions.
Why don't we do a little role play? And I will play Christian Bale and just guide me. Like,
Yeah.
Hey, what are we doing today?
So first, what you're gonna do is you're gonna kiss her on the lips, open mouth for 8 seconds. Then you're gonna shove tongue in, and then you take it out, and then you smile, and then nod, and then spike the camera. You need to tell me what your no-no square is. And then I'll give you some mints and a toothbrush.
Wow, thank you for doing that because I do feel like I got a better understanding of why you're so good at this. I felt really like, I don't want to say turned on, but maybe that's the right way to describe it.
Mm. Yes.
I will say, however, that this does not feel like it's going to create a very organic or chemistry-driven scene?
Yes, I don't think Batman got to where he wanted by thinking with this. It was with this.
Yeah, good point. So do you do that on all your films? You kind of...
Mm-mm. Like, for example, I worked on How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Huh, the live action. I don't remember any intimate scenes in that movie.
You remember... the one who that's doing her Christmas lights and hi, Betty May.
I guess. I mean, you do sound a lot like a character from that movie.
Mm-hmm. So she has big boobs. So I was needed.
Okay. And did anyone touch her boobs? Did she? Because it feels like a intentionally like a PG movie where you wouldn't really want there to be any sort of sexual innuendos in the film.
My job was to make sure no one touched her boobs.
Was that a concern?
Have you seen them?
I don't remember. So were you just like kind of paired with her for the whole film?
Mm-hmm. I was kind of her bodyguard the whole time. And then, of course, and this was not a part of my job, but I made it a part of my job, was calming Jim Carrey down when he would have his panic attacks in the...
Oh, my God. Yeah. That is super intense. And when you're calming someone down during a panic attack, are you also using your whisper voice? And if so, could you just give me a little taste of what that would be like?
I go into his ear and I say, Jim, you're going to be okay. All we have to do is... And then I scream at the top of my lungs. I scream at the top of my lungs. I take off my top. I put it down, take a cup of ice water. Throw it on his head.
That feels so counterintuitive to me. Mm. I cannot imagine how whispering, then screaming in someone's ear, then taking off your shirt and potentially exposing him to some sort of sexual harassment situation, mm-hmm. and then pouring ice on him would help his panic attack.
Well, so something about that, though, is have you ever tried it?
No.
Yeah. So next time... you have a panic attack, mm-hmm. and try it.
Because it'll maybe shake me out of whatever's mm-hmm. going on in my head.
Mm-hmm. Because with Jim, what would happen is sort of, he'd quickly get a boner, but it would go down.
Like the boner would happen like as you're whispering it.
I think the boner happened when he was sort of titty flash. Mm-hmm. And it would just go like...
like as almost fast as like, you flash your tits, his boner would happen, but it would go right down?
Yes. It was like...
that's incredible. Up and down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a real testament to Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm. It was sort of like Have you seen The Dog Whisperer?
No.
That one dog trainer? Caesar?
Oh, Caesar Milan?
Yes.
Yeah, I do know who you're talking about. Yeah, yes. I do. Yes. Yeah. What does that have to do with Jim Carrey's boner?
I was the Caesar Milan of his panic attacks.
Got it.
I Pavloved him into knowing kind of, you know, it's like I am Caesar Milan. He's the dog. I know his bells and whistles.
Wow. I have to say I have learned a lot about intimacy coordinating and, you know, a lot of this is not what I would have expected. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And I have to say, if there's ever another film that we do for this podcast where you are the intimacy coordinator, I want to learn a little more about it. So we'll just keep that in mind.
Of course. I again, like I said, it's why I wake up in the morning and it's why I can live another day. So I would anytime anyone wants.
Well, thank you for your talent and thank you for your time. Regina Butts, I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Wow. How about that, Stephen?
Amazing.
My mind is blown. I need medical attention.
Let's get right on that.
And that's our show for today. Come back next week for an episode with Scott Aukerman. Yes, please. A sincere, heartfelt thank you. A sincere, heartfelt thank you to my guests and your and Stephen's guests as well. Lane Moore, Allison Zeidman, and Ava Bunn. But most importantly, thank you, dear listener, for listening and not fast-forwarding through the Belle and Sebastian conversation, which I believe to be important listening because they're a great band.
Love Belle and Sebastian. What is, okay, I can't wait till a reader writes in. What's your favorite Belle and Sebastian album?
Maybe Tiger Milk. I don't even know.
Oh, okay. It's a good one. They started off with a bang.
I would say just not if you're feeling sinister.
Oh, not if you're feeling sinister. Yeah.
I would say anything but that one. I know everyone's like, oh, that one's so great. I was like, no, it's not. It's not the best one.
Well, you missed, if you haven't seen it pour in the pouring rain on a New York rooftop, you haven't heard it.
Wait, what did they didn't
they
do...
played the whole second album the second night.
Oh, I didn't go that night.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not your favorite album, so yeah.
Well, there you go. No, I would have loved it. I would have had a great time. Either
they
way.
They didn't even bring people on stage to dance because it was too slippery.
I was torn about the dancing on stage.
That's a thing they do.
I know, but every time I'm kind of like, that's cool and all, but I don't know. I kind of want to see Belle and Sebastian, not that guy dancing. I'm just pointing at a random guy in my mind right now.
Yeah.
Also, I think really what you're hearing is jealousy.
Oh, that's
that I wasn't out there dancing around.
There's also a point where they like kind of, he starts talking and then the people on stage they can't really dance because there's not a beat anymore and they don't know what to do and they kind of stand around awkwardly and that's.
Yeah. They're great, though.
Amazing.
All right. Add an explosion sound or something at the end.
Okay.
The Novelizers is hosted by me, Dave Hill, and produced by Stephen Levinson. Hey, Stephen. With Graham Douglas, Cole Emhoff, Kevin Carter, Christine Bullen, Dennis DiClaudio, and Rob Kuttner. Music by Cole Emhoff. Additional editing by Sunita Haberlein. Graphic design by Crystal Dennis. Theme song by Andrew Lynn. Performed by Knotts. Additional support by Elizabeth Tavares. Distributed by Cincinnati Public Radio. The Novelizers is an AI-free podcast. Written, narrated, and edited, and scored entirely by human beings. Can you imagine that? The Novelizers is a work of unauthorized parody. Follow The Novelizers on Instagram, Threads, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And please support us on Patreon. Copyright 2026, Novelizers, LLC.
Do you ever wonder how government in Cincinnati operates? Like, really operates? Sign up for WVXU's City Government 101 newsletter. You'll learn all the basics and more in a weekly email, giving you the tools you need to stay informed and get involved. Sign up at WVXU.org.